Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Well, hello there. This is Fred Brack reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Our State magazine. Today's reading of Our State is underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974 and underwriting our podcast for over 10 years. Thank you, Carter Glass. They can be reached at 919-781-1973 if you want to talk about insurance or thanking them for supporting Our State magazine and the North Carolina Reading Service. We're going to return one more time to the October 2020 edition of Our State magazine, celebrating North Carolina. This has been the annual mountain issue, but today, being the last reading of the month, we're going to read this article from the series The Dynamic Decade, and we've been in the 1960s all year long. This particular article is entitled The Music of Unity. Although slow to desegregate, one college shifts racial sentiments on campus, not with court orders or violence, but through the power of music. Written by Philip Girard. There's a photo here on the cover, black and white photo, taken a long time ago. I think the year is in the caption here. And it's a gentleman playing the drums and a gentleman playing the bass. And the bass player is black and the gentleman playing the drums is white. When the Dave Brubeck Quartet, including bassist Eugene Wright and drummer Joe Morello, returned to East Carolina College in 1963, racial dynamics on campus had shifted since the group's first tense visit in 1958. As the civil rights movement begins to crack the color line of the early 1960s, often through the intervention of federal courts, East Carolina College in Greenville, later East Carolina University, hits upon a novel solution, racial unity through music. The stage is set, literally, on the evening of February 5th, 1958 at East Carolina's Wright Auditorium by a concert that almost doesn't happen. The Dave Brubeck Quartet, already a big act in the U.S. and on the brink of becoming international stars, takes the stage for a sound check. James Tucker, Dean of Student Affairs, walks in and sees three white musicians, pianist Brubeck, saxophonist Paul Desmond, and drummer Joe Morello, and one black one, Eugene Wright, a newcomer to the band. When the act was booked, it was an all-white combo. Despite pleas from promoters, Brubeck insisted that Wright accompany the band on tour using the same facilities as any white musician. The people that seemed to like to continue with racist ideas are just buying old myths without really investigating how important so many of the early players were, no matter what color they might have been, Brubeck later tells interviewer Caroline Crawford. Dean Tucker demands of Brubeck, "What's he doing here?" Brubeck responds coolly, "He's my bass player." The university has a strict policy, the dean informs him, "No black performers on stage." Brubeck stands on a principle that will cost the quartet 23 canceled shows at other colleges. If Eugene can't play, we won't play. The matter quickly escalates. Tucker reports the situation to President John D. Messick, who telephones Governor Luther Hodges' office for advice. He is told that ECC is contractually obligated to pay the musicians for their performance, whether they are allowed to play or not. Brubeck later tells Crawford, the students sensed what was going on and why the concert was delayed. They could see that the band bus was parked behind the auditorium and that we were there and we were set up, yet we were not going on. So it just tore the place up. They had been stamping on the floor the whole time that governor and the president of the school were talking. You could just hear the pounding of feet, demanding us. Messick goes to the auditorium to negotiate with Brubeck. "We don't want another Little Rock," he tells Brubeck, referring to the incident at Little Rock Central High School in Arkansas the previous September, in which the Arkansas National Guard blocked 9 black children attempting to go to class in the previously all-white school until confronted by federal troops. Messick backs off a little, tells Brubeck that the quartet can play their show as planned under the condition that Wright will stay in the background. Brubeck tells the story of what happens next. "I told Eugene his mic was broken and he should use the announcement mic that was in front of the band for his solo. And I called the solo early in the concert rather than its usual spot. When we hit the stand, man, we were smoking," he says. "After that nonsense, for some reason, we were really up. Well, the audience went crazy. We integrated that school that night. Pressured by a student petition, the Board of Trustees decides that in the future, black entertainers may perform on campus, but only with approval of the president." When Dr. Leo W. Jenkins assumes the presidency in the spring of 1960, he is determined to shape events rather than simply watch them play out. The sentiment on campus is changing from general acceptance of a whites-only enrollment to a more inclusive stance reflected in the student newspaper, the East Carolinian, in January of the following year. There is no longer any real question concerning school integration. Any questions have already been answered by federal courts and by successfully integrated schools. Those diehard Southerners who insist on participating in contemporary Greek tragedy will be the ones to suffer most from this point on. The editors go on to pledge the support of the East Carolinian and hope the student body will follow to meet and accept in a rational, civilized manner the wave which is sure to come. On April 29, 1961, the Infra-Fraternity Council presents the Count Basie Orchestra, not just for a concert as part of Greek weekend, but also for a question and answer session after the performance. Many of the students, steeped in racial stereotypes of black musicians as unschooled minstrel performers, discover them to be educated, erudite, and, as the East Carolinian reports, possessed of immense personal charm. Yet there are still a few offensive reminders that they are in the Jim Crow South. One BAM member casually indicates a restroom marked white only and remarks, "I feel that a man is a man, no matter what." By popular demand, Count Basie is invited for a repeat performance in July. Students host the band members for a pre-show prime rib dinner, then lead them in a procession to the venue. When the band takes the stage, the auditorium erupts in a spontaneous ovation. It's not all smooth sailing on the way to racial equality on campus, though. When rhythm and blues star Chuck Jackson fails to appear for his scheduled performance a few months after Count Basie's triumphant reprise, unidentified persons lynch him in effigy. In May 1961, President Jenkins presents to the Board of Trustees a plan to admit qualified black students. "The consensus among board members with whom I have spoken," he writes to a board member, "seems to be that the only thing we can do is admit them without a lot of fanfare, making the procedure as routine as possible, and explain to the students that their cooperation will be needed. The alternative," he warns, "is to wait for a court order and endure the blast of negative press sure to follow." He doesn't win completely, but that summer, black teachers enroll in 2-week graduate seminar class, while other black students attend off-campus extension classes at Camp Lejeune. Surely, but oh so slowly, things are changing. Jenkins works with Dr. Andrew A. Best, a well-regarded local physician and member of the Pitt County Interracial Committee, to integrate the campus. And the now deliberate parade of A-list black performers marches on. Folk singer Josh White, pop icon Johnny Nash, the Ramsey Lewis Trio, the Coasters, William Warfield, star of Porgy and Bess. The East Carolinian champions the cause of James Meredith, attempting to enroll at the University of Mississippi, and gives big play to the performances an ongoing rebuke to ECC's racially exclusive policy. At last, in the fall of 1962, Laura Marie Leary of Vanceboro becomes the first black student to enroll full-time at ECC. The following year, three others join her, Lillian T. Jones, Nellie R. Ross, and Benny E. Teal, who will be named editor of the East Carolinian in 1966. In 1965, Hubert Everett Walters becomes the first black student to graduate ECC with a master's degree, fittingly, in music education. In 1969, Black History Week is established on campus, celebrating black history, culture, and music. The East Carolinian runs essays like Janice McNeil's God and Music, in which she writes that music has been the black man's second heart. That same year, students vote to ban the playing of Dixie, written for a New York minstrel show and later adopted as the unofficial anthem of the Confederacy at campus events. Meanwhile, the concerts by world-class black performers carry on, featuring Louis Satchmo Armstrong, Ray Charles, The Fifth Dimension, and Dionne Warwick. Count Basie returns for a third dazzling performance, and the tradition continues into the 1970s with Duke Ellington and his orchestra, the Ike and Tina Turner Review, Richie Havens, Stevie Wonder, and The Temptations. Of all the luminaries who perform at ECC, no concert holds more resonance than the return of the Dave Brubeck Quartet in 1963, now world famous for their 1959 album, Time Out. This time, President Jenkins personally recognizes the band members on stage. He presents Eugene Wright with a commemorative plaque, reaching out to clasp Wright's hand in a firm handshake. Our writer, Philip Girard, is the recipient of the 2019 North Carolina Award for Literature. And coming in November, young members of the Eastern Band of Cherokee build community. You're listening to Our State Magazine on the North Carolina Reading Service. If you have any comments or questions, please call the studios at 919-832-5138. We hope you are enjoying the weekly broadcasts. Or listening to us on, weekly broadcast. And we also hope some of you are enjoying the podcasts that are available on iTunes and other services, including right at the radio station itself, ncreadingservice.org. And now a little bit of Asia in Appalachia. What's it like to live in the most meditative homes in the North Carolina mountains? Well, Come Inside, written by Morgan Sykes. The Dolgast's home sits on the gentle slope of a hillside near Fairview, just southeast of Asheville, looking out over a panorama of horse pastures and hazy, undulating mountains. Tina and Hans live here with their two daughters on quintessential Blue Ridge land, in a home that is anything but typical in this area. "See the color of the windows?" Hans says, pointing to the burnt orange tint. "We had them custom color matched to what they paint their torii gates in Japan." He smiles. "Isn't that fun?" The commanding lines of the roof drop into steeply angled eaves, evoking a Shinto shrine. The porch, ornamented with graceful ironwork, whose horizontal lines recall samurai swords, was constructed with white oak and black locust. "This is what fence posts are made of here in Appalachia," Hans says, referring to the latter. "It's the local rot-free wood." That's the thing about the Dolgast's house. It's neither an orthodox homage to Japanese architecture nor a traditional mountain cabin. The building style is the unique result of interpreting Japanese design through an Appalachian lens. Hans, whose long beard and sinewy frame recall mountain men of generations past, has nurtured a long-standing obsession with Appalachia. As an environmental education major at Warren Wilson College in Swannanoa, he earned a concentration in Appalachian studies. In his final semester, he spent 6 weeks in a van traveling around Appalachia, meeting with furniture makers and other craftspeople, musicians, and herbalists, and studying wildflowers and medicinal plants. Hans was further interspersed in traditional folkways when he spent 2 weeks learning from the legendary primitive skills expert Eustace Conway, the hardscrabble living off the land subject of The Last American Man, written by Eat, Pray, Love author Elizabeth Gilbert. It was while working with Conway that Hans decided to build his own primitive Appalachian cabin. He constructed the little cottage in Boone using mostly reclaimed and scavenged materials and putting it together with hand tools. It was totally off the grid, Hans says, no electricity or running water. To bathe, he had to run creek water to his enormous clawfoot bathtub and then start a fire underneath to warm it. The only meat I ate for probably 7 years was deer I harvested myself, he says. It was just a very pure, simple, affordable life where the only bill I had was for a cell phone. During those postgraduate years, Hans chased his passion for building by working as a contractor and eventually spearheading projects for friends. He met Tina when she borrowed his friend's truck. She and Hans spent their first official date together planting ginseng at his cabin. In 2002, 5 years before the Dolgasts would officially incorporate their custom building company as Jade Mountain Builders, Hans was studying furniture making and discovering the woodworking of Japanese-American architect George Nakashima, whose reverence for imperfections and rounded edges electrified Hans. Japanese style started creeping into his projects. Years ago, while planting native ferns and wildflowers in a Japanese-inspired configuration, he told a friend that it was a Japanese Appalachian garden. He was like, "You should call it Japalachian," Jahan says. The term resonated with him, and it stuck. Today, he and Tina use it to describe one of Jade Mountain Builder's architectural styles. Hans isn't the only one in the Asheville area who's found peace in the convergence of Japanese and Appalachian architectural styles. About half an hour northeast in Fairview, Jim and Susan Jones' homes sits at the bottom of a holler in Black Mountain, with a sweeping roof angled to offset the mountains beyond. That has a similar Japanese feel. Like the Dolgast's house, the Joneses' juxtaposition of an Asian-influenced house in the North Carolina mountains isn't jarring. Instead, the Appalachian rhododendron thickets harmonize with the Eastern-inspired stacked stone and dramatic eaves. Wherein a rhododendron grows, but we've also got that long view, which is really nice, Jim says. It's the best of both worlds. He's referring to the feeling of seclusion with unobstructed views, but he could easily be talking about the meditative melding of Eastern design in his Western Carolina retreat. While there's not yet a Japanese-inspired building boom in the area, the Dolgast and Jones homes, just over the mountains from one another, speak to how inspiration rises and is reinterpreted to be built anew on distant soil. In the case of both homes, imagination and a profound desire for mountain sanctuary have produced a new building language, Japanese with an Appalachian twang. The Joneses can relate to the idea of simply finding something beautiful and functional without belaboring the reasons behind it. Married for 40 years, Jim and Susan decided to retire to Black Mountain from Greensboro, and they hired Livingstone Design Plus Build to help them carry out their vision. According to Jim, the couple's previous home had been more traditionally Southern. It was big, grand, with lots of molding, he says. This time we wanted to go in the opposite direction. We wanted something contemporary. Livingstone's Sean Sullivan, the son of a Marine, had lived in Japan twice as a child, and the architecture always struck a chord with him. I have fond memories of those years, he says. Sullivan remembers sleeping on mats in rooms with paper walls and sliding doors. He remembers the temples, the tranquility, when the Joneses started to describe the type of home they wanted. I thought, wow, let's do something with Asian infusion. There were two parameters the design had to work within. First, a full lot of wild turkeys and the occasional black bear is located in an arts and crafts community, so the home had to fulfill those requirements. Second, the Joneses are avid art collectors, so the Livingstone team needed to provide enough wall space to showcase the couple's beloved pieces. The Joneses are also proud North Carolinians. Jim's family has lived here for generations, and he says hard work is in his DNA. His grandfather began working in the Ramseur textile mills when he was 9 years old, and he eventually established a Chevrolet dealership. Jim's father took it over, and then Jim and his brother Steve took it over from him. Something of a serial entrepreneur, Jim, along with Steve, later closed the dealership and developed it into an apartment community. Jim and Susan also ran Joymongers, a craft brewery in Greensboro. Although they claim to be semi-retired, their life in the Piedmont remains active and full. They have two adult children who have their hand in their businesses, and Jim also sings in a rock band called the B-Sides. They made the decision that their home in Black Mountain would be a place for respite and stillness. While talking about the design of the house with John Petrie, an architect for Livingstone, what emerged was something that surprised the Joneses. When he put it on paper, it just kind of spoke to us, Susan said. We just looked at each other and went, we didn't know we liked that, but we do. Inside, the Japanese influence is evident in the stacked stone grand staircase, floating shelving, and recessed elevated reading room. The built-ins flanking the kitchen and the incorporation of the indoor-outdoor spaces, like screened-in porches, also reiterate the Japanese theme. The couple advocated for a neutral palette and imperfect artful wishes whenever possible. For example, when Jim was selecting flooring from a local source, he had a surprising request. I said, I want the naughtiest, most figurative pieces you can find. I want the pieces nobody else wants, he says. So you get this old barn floor feel that contrasts with the contemporary feel of the space. You're looking for this natural tension between things. That tension isn't for everyone. Susan remembers that the first time her son saw the imperfect finish of the walls, he worried that his parents had been had by an unsavory contractor. His mother reassured him that the bumpiness was deliberate and desired. Susan and Jim consider their home to be a work of art, the result of a highly collaborative process. Although they are not professional builders like the Dolgasts, Jim is proud that he and Susan laid hands on everything in the house. The home, Susan says, is where, after decades of hard work and raising kids, she and Jim became a couple again. Today, the Joneses relish drinking in what feels to them like an ocean view as they watch the weather roll in over Swannanoa Valley. On clear days in the meditative stillness of their home, they can see Mount Mitchell. We get the reflection of the sunrise. We get these deep reds, Jim says. Everything is always changing. The Dolgasts were finally able to start construction of their dream home in 2010. Tina, who runs Jade Mountain with Hans, is tall with honey-colored hair and a gentle presence that contrasts with her husband's excitable energy. Although they integrate Japanese design elements like sliding mulberry paper shoji screens and lantern-style lights, she insists we're not trying to claim anything. It's just this aesthetic we really like. She called it the honoring of the elements, the connection to nature within the home. Hans calls it the honoring of two rich traditions. If you're building a Japanese-style home in Appalachia, it's honoring both, he says. For Hans, who cut his teeth as a builder using locally sourced materials with an eye toward minimalism, the strengths of both architectural styles are emphasized. Harmony with nature, craftsmanship, and the celebration of natural materials, neutral palettes and imperfections. All of this together highlights an almost spiritual connection between the traditions. It's what I find to be beautiful, he says. If the Jones home is Asian-inspired by collaboration, the Dolgast home is Asian-inspired by obsession, brought into being by Hans, who fused his Appalachian heritage with his affinity for what he learned about Japan. As he gives a tour of his 5.5 acres where his daughters are growing up and where he lives with the woman of his dreams, it is apparent that he can not believe his good fortune. The young man who stalked deer and Boone and bathed in creek water has built with his wife a home entirely of his own vision and creation. There's a declaration of hope in the details. The couple chose to finish much of the wood siding with rust and vinegar so that it will get even more beautiful as it ages. And the invocation of Torii gates in the burnt and the orange paint around the windows. Torii gates in Japan are used to mark the entrance to a sacred place, Han says. So for us, this is all a sacred place. I'm trying to figure out how long this article is going to be here. There's actually a picture of the next page. It says North Carolina celebrates fall color. Big Creek. Hikers who head 2 miles north from the Big Creek trailhead on the Appalachian Trail might find a stretch of the creek sheltered by a cathedral of golden trees. Like this, Big Creek, part of the part of the Great Smoky Mountains National Park, is known for having it all: camping, fishing, waterfalls, and horseback riding. We see a picture of this creek coming at us from the woodlands. The camera is really low in front of some of the rocks in the creek, which themselves have a smattering of fall leaves on top of them of various colors that have dropped and not landed in the water, but rather landed on rocks that don't have water rushing over them. It's a little bit of a time exposure photograph, or slow shutter speed, I guess we should actually say, so the water looks has a lot of white flow to it as the little bubbles and everything mold together for the camera lens. And as the creek goes from wide right up in front to narrow at the rear where it disappears into the forest, the banks is gently sloping down to this creek, which is just completely filled with rocks. And on the hillsides there are some bushes that have not yet turned the fall covers, but overhead we have lots and lots of trees that have lots and lots of fall color, almost all of that being yellowish. And there's another picture here, of the Cherahola Skyway. This 43-mile route winds from Robbinsville to Tellico Plains, Tennessee. It's a picturesque connection between neighbors. Even its name is about togetherness. It's a blend of the Cherokee and Nantahala National Forest. On the left-hand side, we see the two-lane roadway coming out of the hills and disappearing a little bit lower on the left-hand side. All of the rest of it is a continuation of the downward-sloping mountain and its fall-colored trees. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Our State Magazine, and I hope you enjoyed it and that you'll be sure to listen next time. I'm Fred Brack, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's reading of Our State Magazine was underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Our State Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, call the studios 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.